Hi, I'm Catherine Menke Ward, and I'm looking forward to a great blogging event today. I'm a senior editor at Reason Magazine, and I'm here with my journalist colleague,
Jamel Blue.
And we've got a variety of topics to cover today, including the recent George Bush interview with Matt Lauer. We're going to talk about the deliciousness of cheese and the perils of subsidizing it, and also journalistic bias, and hopefully get through to whether or not money can buy you love. So let's start out with George Bush. He is back after a few weeks slash months slash years of silence. And
it's been a while. It's
I must admit I'm having a little bit of Bush nostalgia, and I did not expect that in myself. I thought that I had equal opportunity despair and hatred over all politicians, but seeing him on this Matt Lauer interview, kind of familiar, bumbling George Bush, it filled my heart with a little bit of a warm feeling.
I had the opposite reaction. I can't stand any of that guy's facial tics, and so when he smirks, it makes me dislike his face even more, independent of what he's saying, too. It's
right.
Just like his face.
So let's talk about a couple of the things he covered in that interview and in other interviews that he's been giving to promote his new book, Decision Points. One thing that he talked about was regrets, which I know was what I was most interested in. And in particular, he covered the question of whether he regretted going into Iraq. And
yeah.
I thought it was interesting that what he essentially said to Lauer was that he was, no one was more upset and angry than he was not to discover weapons of mass destruction. I thought that was an interesting phrasing, that he was sort of upset and angry that they weren't there. Did that strike you at all, or sort of how did you read his accounting of his decision to go into Iraq?
I found that entire little bit really interesting. Because he says that, and then Lauer asks him, you know, if you knew what you knew then, would you have still done it? And he sort of sidesteps the question. He actually avoids saying ever if he would have gone into Iraq if he knew there weren't weapons of mass destruction. And so part of me thinks that he may have, like, that he views going into Iraq as the right decision sort of regardless of the actual cause, or the actual reason for doing so,
mm-hmm.
and but he knows it isn't exactly like a politically, you know, good thing to say, even now that he's 2 years out of the presidency. That's a part I found interesting, like his sidestepping the question, because it leads to speculation over, you know, does he view it as worth it, even without weapons of mass destruction? I think he does. Not in any malicious way, just sort of, I think he viewed taking out Saddam Hussein as an important strategic goal, and that weapons of mass destruction would have been nice, but if not that, then something else.
Right. Well, and he does, in the book, my understanding from his interview and from other things that I've read, he emphasizes the case for the war, which he made at the American Enterprise Institute, most famously, right, as he was going in, that there's also this kind of ideological reason to go in, that all people are deserving of liberty, and that you know, the oppression under Saddam Hussein can't, you know, couldn't be allowed to stand, just
right.
on the value of liberty, and sort of over and above maybe tactical considerations for the safety of U.S. citizens. And I think that's kind of where he's fallen back to. I wonder, and I wonder what you would say about this, what would have happened if he had made that argument from the first minute? If it had never been about weapons of mass destruction, if it had never been about harboring terrorists, if it had always been just about this is the right thing to do because those people are oppressed and unfree, would the American public have bought that ever? Or did he need this sort of realist strategic account also to sell the war?
I think he needed the strategic account as well. I mean, if you remember, all the polling done before the war showed that it was a plurality here in favor of the war without United Nations approval.
Mm-hmm.
And then a why can't I say this word?
A bunch of people.
A bunch of people. I mean, an equal number of people were, it was on both sides, for and against the war, without UN approval. Like, it was evenly split through the middle. And I think that had, Bush not provided that strategic account of why we're going to war, then the shift would have been more towards against the war than for it. I think Americans like, the idea of spreading democracy to other countries or whatnot, but aren't exactly keen on expending blood and treasure to do so unless there are other more concrete reasons.
I think that's right. That's certainly what we've seen as support for the war has continued to dwindle, even though, it's now someone else's war in, I think,
right.
very fundamental ways. It's now Obama's war. And maybe what that tells us is just that the American public actually does have at least some ability to separate out partisan sentiment and personal views about the individual commanders in chief and to actually just say, no, we still think this war was a bad idea, which I guess, gives me a little bit of hope for the American public, surprisingly, that consistent views do persist across partisan divides. Of course, the other element of these interviews that Bush is giving right now is the kind of gossip side, the personal side. And
right.
in particular, I think people have already made a fair amount of hay out of this story, which the teenage George Bush drives his mother to the hospital or to the doctors after she has a miscarriage and sees the fetus. And I was struck I sort of read about that and then watched the interview, and I was struck in the interview by the fact that Bush actually goes out of his way to insist the reason he told that story isn't for the pro-life lesson that you might think he would have drawn, although he says that is relevant. He says it's a coming-of-age story, and that it's about his relationship with his parents. I don't know quite what to make of that. It seems like a deeply bizarre thing that your mother's miscarried fetus in a jar on the way that the doctors would be a really nice, sort of warm coming-of-age moment that you would tell in that way, but that's what he says. He says this is the moment he knew his mother trusted him and respected him and that he could be called on to help her through this difficult time. He also, of course, says that his one reason that he ran for the presidency is because he wanted to see if he could measure up to his father, although he phrases it as his father never let him down. This wasn't about doing it better.
Right.
It was just about kind of coming up to the standard that he saw as like the benchmark of manliness. So I guess I actually found it sort of somewhat, pleasing to have this alternate view of the Bush family, of this sort of strange but warm family where everyone really respects each other.
Instead of the weird, like, Oedipal version that's
right.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the fetus story was really weird. I'd read about the fetus story, and then actually hearing Bush say it, my first thought was like, I don't know how I'd react if my mom, had my mom had a miscarriage. I don't know how I'd react if she was like, Jamel, I want to show you the fetus in this jar.
Yeah.
I mean, families, families have their own things, so, more power to the Bushes for this being their sign of like trust and commitment and stuff, but it's sort of the thing that, like, it's nice to have this other, nice to be able to see the Bushes as being, actually human in a way that we haven't seen before. But, the parts of the interview, I guess I was more interested in were, like, the ones that have to do with policy.
Sure.
But that's mainly because I don't care that much about the actual personalities of politicians and leaders outside of how they apply to policy.
And yet, I think it's pretty clear a lot of the coverage so far and promises, you know, this promises to continue will be about the psychological profile that the book depicts. Do you think that that's something bad or pernicious about the way that our political dialogue works, or is this just kind of people are gossips and that's how it's always going to be?
I think if people are gossips and that's how it's always going to be. Doesn't really. I mean, I can't remember any exact examples off the top of my head, but I know for a fact that, you know, in the 19th century, people gossiped about presidents in the same way.
Sure.
Talking about ex-president's illegitimate child and so on and so forth.
We actually just recently made a video here at Reason. We have a separate website, reason.tv, in which we sort of simulate what campaign ads might have been like.
I saw that.
Between Jefferson and Adams, and my particular favorite phrase is, I think that it's Adams accusing Jefferson of being a hideous hermaphroditical character. So it certainly makes, you know, monkey-faced buffoon sound quite in context with the rest of the tone of American political dialogue.
Right, now I thought that was a really great and well-done video, just because it's a complaint I always have, just that, you know,
that we're more partisan than ever, and the idea that somehow things are worse now. Yeah.
And, like, just like the slogans back then were so much more, you know, they're so much more cutting. Like, Democrats are the party of, like, a Roman revolution. Like, that's,
yeah.
That's a political slogan.
Right, right. So you're actually calling for a return to to more ad hominem.
A return to the most outlandish rhetoric we can manage.
Which actually segues us quite nicely, I think, into another topic we wanted to talk, one we wanted to cover, which is Keith Olbermann. He's back tonight, Tuesday night, on the air, and that after a pretty good sized tempest in a largish teapot, in which he gave donations to Democratic candidates against NBC's policy for its employees, got caught, although it almost seems like an overstatement to say caught in our era of total campaign donation disclosure. It just was out there, as one might expect, and then was temporarily removed without pay, and is now back, most famously defended by Rachel Maddow, who wanted to use the occasion to draw a distinction between MSNBC and Fox. I have to say I didn't find her case particularly compelling, that the fact that MSNBC has this policy against donations and Fox doesn't somehow means that the two networks are not similarly ideological. It seems pretty clear to me that they are increasingly similar in their kind of tone and stridency, just on opposite sides of the aisle. But were you convinced by her case?
I mean, I didn't actually. I paid attention to the whole Olbermann saga, but I didn't actually see Maddow's defense. Mostly because I don't have cable, first of all. And even if I did, I wouldn't spend my valuable cable hours on a news channel.
Well, I mean, I think the I don't have cable prestige thing aside, there were lots of other ways to consume that information.
True.
But just in general, sort of the case about the appropriateness of clearly opinionated news personalities expressing those opinions in dollar form around campaign time. I mean, what do you make of that as a controversy?
As a controversy, I don't see it as such a big deal. I mean, it obviously was not cool that Olbermann violated NBC's donation policies on donating political candidates. And I know defenders have brought up that Joe Scarborough has also made donations, but the difference, of course, is that, like, Scarborough asked first.
Right. I find that really creepy. I don't know if this was your reaction too, but the notion that that someone's employer, and of course I understand why NBC or MSNBC would choose to have this policy in place, but the notion that someone has to go to their employer and seek permission to participate in the political process in this way actually struck me as, in a lot of ways, far more sinister then, or sort of potentially damaging to democracy, I guess, to go ahead and go with full overstatement, than the idea that, you know, Keith Olbermann and Sarah Palin are kicking money around to candidates that they like.
Yeah, I was actually about to say that.
Yeah.
That part strikes me a lot more problematic than Olbermann giving money. And then, you know, the other thing, right, is that Olbermann's an opinionated political commenter. You know, most of the folks in Fox News are. Maddow is. It's sort of, you know, it's really silly to be surprised or get upset that they're donating to candidates who line up with their ideological views.
Yeah.
Of course they would. They care about politics. They're really ideological, and they're going to give money to people who agree with them. That's not a big deal. And I don't think it really influences, you know, how they do their jobs. Maybe if Olbermann were inviting on his show people that he had given money to, that would be a concern.
Like a disclosure would probably take care of that, right?
Right. Like, there are other, you don't need a company policy on this because there are other things that would take care of, like, most of the potential conflicts of interest.
Right. Well, and of course, the sort of secondary version of this that we see is Slate, and I think, as part of the Washington Post company, forbidding, and NPR as well, forbidding its employees to attend rallies, including the John Stewart, this is not a rally, or maybe it is, I'm not sure, rally. Which, again, seems to me, you know, I guess I continue to find it surprising that this issue of donations is central to this debate when it actually seems like there's, you know, I don't know if it's fair to call it a trend, but there's certainly a increasingly frequent attention paid to the fact that people who work for media organizations, even, I assume, sort of behind the scenes researchers and clerks and the like, having to check out of the political process, while at the same time, for instance, we're perfectly happy for government employees of all stripes to participate in these ways. It seems like, if anything, although I also wouldn't make the case for this, it seems like if anything, the case would be stronger that you might say, you know, public sector unions have such a very, very clear conflict of interest in giving to candidates that we should be more wary of that. Again, I don't think that should be banned either. But
no, but I agree. The case for that is certainly a lot stronger than the case for a TV news anchor.
Right. And do you think it's just because we have this magical idea about journalistic objectivity? I mean, I'm pretty skeptical of that as a concept that actually exists in the world in general. But the notion that somehow our news anchors and even our commentators are supposed to be these Olympian figures who are above it all, that dates from some lost kind of Hutchins Commission mid-20th century notion of what the press was supposed to be like.
Yeah, no, part of me thinks that the companies themselves know that journalistic objectivity isn't really a realistic thing. Because, I mean, I can imagine the reasoning being that if you allow your employees to begin, you know, attending political rallies, donating money, then you yourself as an employer are forced to recognize the fact that, you know, that you can't separate these people from their political opinions no matter how hard you try. Which then could, like, you know, force some, you know, soul searching about what it is you're actually doing. And so better to avoid the dissonance and just, like, forbid your employees from doing anything than have to deal with the fact that, you know, they have political opinions that, you know, you can't actually erase, even in their work.
Right. And there's this kind of strange reverse logic, in particular, to the ban on journalists giving donations, right? I mean, a ban on politicians giving donations to journalists would make perfect sense.
right.
And in fact, I'm sure that policy exists in perhaps not quite those words at virtually every news organization. But, you know, not realizing your political views in cash form does not make them any less real.
Right. If we're taking seriously the idea that, you know, money is a form of speech, then I'm not sure what distinguishes Keith Olbermann endorsing a Democrat on national television from giving money to a Democrat. And really, you know, in the scheme of things, an endorsement from Keith Olbermann on national television is worth a lot more than whatever the limit is for individual spending for a candidate.
Like, that's certainly true.
Keith Olbermann gives $2,000, great. Keith Olbermann says that this guy is awesome on his show, even better.
Right. Right. Although, you know, now that I've articulated it, I quite like the idea of politicians giving donations to journalists. So if there are any politicians watching this, you know, send a check my way. So, of course, another issue with money in this campaign cycle has been the question of self-funded candidates and also the extent to which being the side with the cash helps you win. And I think this election has the idea that money can buy you love has taken a thumping in this election.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of pieces. I saw one in New York Times and Washington Post in the Wall Street Journal noting how all the wealthiest candidates, I think all of them lost their elections. Right down, you know, general elections and before that, most had lost their primaries and so on and so forth. And I'm not sure if the conclusion from that is that money doesn't matter so much as it is, for at least for a candidate running in a major office, it's where you get that money from that matters. I wrote about this for The Prospect last month, but there's a lot of research to suggest that, you know, someone who can cut themselves a check for $1 million, it's cool, they can buy themselves lots of media attention and so on and so forth. But someone who can raise $1 million from local constituents, local interest groups, local business interests, they're in a much stronger position by virtue of the fact that they have that tangible connection to the community, as opposed to simply like having money. Like that's money, in this case, money isn't necessarily buying anything. Money is giving you, or money represents the campaigning you've done.
Money is polling, essentially.
Right, right. And money is signaling, too. Like if you're in a primary and you're raising $100,000, $200,000 for a house race from a local interest, then that signals to the party that, hey, we want to invest more money in this guy because he obviously has those connections. And it's sort of like it makes you stand out as a strong candidate. And the other thing, too, is that running for national office is actually very hard, and it's a whole skill set that you have to cultivate. And so oftentimes these very wealthy candidates are people who it seems like were like, I have a lot of money, what should I do with it? I should run for Senate, I should become a senator, without realizing that becoming a senator requires a lot more than simply having a lot of money. I think Matt Iglesias made this suggestion on his blog over the weekend, but that if you're a rich person who wants higher office, then really your best bet is to start small, to use that money to win a mayoral race or to win a lesser state office, and then from there work up once you have the necessary skills. Just to sort of say, you know, I have $140 million to blow, let me become governor of California, isn't a very good idea. There are better ways you can spend that money.
And yet, one of the arguments that you often hear in favor of limiting campaign spending, either through campaign finance rules or shortening the campaign season or publicly financing elections, one of the arguments that you hear is, well, the skill set that might lead to a successful campaign is actually not at all the same thing as what makes a good leader or a good politician. So,
right.
You know, I think the sort of contrarian argument for self-funded elections is, you know, maybe there is this category of person out there who isn't a glad hander and isn't going to be able to raise money, but who nonetheless would make a great senator, say, and you know, should go for it. And I certainly don't hear you saying, and I don't imagine many people are saying that, you know, self-funded candidates shouldn't exist or should somehow be banned. But I do think that they do tend to be maligned, and that so much so that in some campaign finance rules, mostly on the state level, there are provisions where if you're running against a self-funded candidate, you actually are allowed to match their money, right? You're allowed to raise more money. So I think we do have this slight schizophrenia where we say, you know, money shouldn't matter in elections, money is corrupting, but also at the same time recognize that it is incredibly important, and that to run against someone where you're at a fiscal disadvantage can really put a candidate kind of at odds. So I wonder if maybe seeing a bunch of these well-heeled, individually funded candidates lose might take a little wind out of the sails of the, you know, money is everything, and that is the most important kind of corrupting factor in our political process.
I actually hope it does. I'm sort of on campaign finance. I'm a fan of the maxim: you want to enlarge the pot, but you want floors, not ceilings, right? That you want. The problem isn't really the amount of money in politics. The problem is, like, for liberals, the problem is where that money is coming from and what incentives different actors have as far as raising money is concerned. Like, if you're spending $1 billion in an election season, but 70% of that comes from small donors, that actually isn't a bad thing. That's people getting involved in the process and participating. If you're spending $1 billion and 70% comes from, like, a handful of actors, then you have an issue. So anything that sort of moves the question away from how do we limit money in politics to how do we better create incentives for the right money in politics, I'm a fan of.
That's interesting. And I think that actually, I mean, you would agree that that sets you apart from other folks, you know, just for instance, at the Prospect. I mean,
right.
And I'm actually much more inclined to agree with you, although I think, you know, we were talking earlier in the Olbermann case about how we probably should take seriously the idea of money as speech. And if that's true, I think as a sort of analytical matter, it does make sense to be aware of where political money is coming from. But as a matter of what should be legal or you know, permitted or accepted, I personally am wary, you know, even if all of our elections were funded by, you know, one big union and one big, you know, chamber of commerce type entity and a couple of big companies and then one really rich dude. You know, I'm not sure on the token of money is political speech, what, if anything, is permissible to do about that. I'm not convinced that there's a case to be made, even in that scenario, that we should be passing laws to change the way campaigns are funded. As it happens, that's not anywhere near how campaigns are funded. We don't find ourselves in that situation. But
I was going to say, I'm not sure. I mean, in that situation would be so extreme, right, that, like, I would be in favor of passing laws to do something about it. But, like, in the current situation where, you know, there are existing and potential mechanisms for countering the influence of some kinds of money, you know, having restrictions on what people can spend doesn't strike me as a good idea. I'm far more fan of, say, saying, creating counterweights in the system, so, like, giving more power to political parties to raise more money from small donors, to match that money, to sort of give candidates an incentive to stick with political parties. I mean, I'm not sure if we want to get into this, but, like, I'm a very big fan of the political party. I think they should be stronger. And part of that reason is because, as far as a counterweight or a balance in the system is concerned, political parties can be a very effective one to outside groups, to not just corporations or, like, quote-unquote special interests, but really anyone who isn't directly involved with the governing process.
And why is it that you think that that's what needs to be balanced? I mean, I actually find that very interesting, but why is it that people who are inside the process should be used to balance people who are outside the process in that way? What is it about outsiders or the way their interests might influence politics that makes you nervous?
Accountability. more or less. I mean, when it comes down to it, political parties are accountable in the public, are accountable to the public in a way that most organizations or most outside the government organizations simply aren't. And I think it's on the balance better to have government more influenced by people who are accountable than people who aren't.
Right. And yet, I think there is at least a certain way in which, you know, ultimately it's still just about the politicians themselves. I mean, we don't have party-style ballots and that, you know, we have these sort of convenient individual human proxies where if there's a perception that this particular guy is funded entirely by, say, the steel industry, you know, we can kind of vote him out on those grounds without necessarily needing these other entities. That said, you know, I do think your point that simply having lots of players counterbalancing each other is probably the strength of the system. To my mind, that's an argument for just freeing up all manner of campaign donations and just letting a free-for-all happen on the airwaves and elsewhere in the political process. You know, of course, I was, at least in this cycle, I was secretly hoping that money could turn out to be the decisive factor in, for instance, Prop 19 in California, where legalizers outspent their opponents and yet didn't manage to get up over the 50% mark. So I think there is also just a question of whether we should be skeptical of or concerned about when there's imbalances in spending anywhere. And I would argue that stuff like Prop 19, you know, although I don't like the outcome, shows if the people of the state aren't ready to legalize, they're not ready, and it doesn't matter how much money you spend.
I mean, it also shows that, like, you should have ballots for legalizing marijuana on election years where old people aren't the only ones voting.
Right. That is absolutely true. The voting is for old people phenomenon immortalized on, who was it that made that t-shirt? Urban Outfitters, maybe somebody that caused a little controversy a few years back is certainly worth keeping in mind. And in fact, the Prop 19 case is interesting because that initiative was pushed by a bunch of medical marijuana folks who had kind of a commercial interest in moving forward more quickly on the legalization stuff.
Right.
And as we've reported in Reason, a lot of the long-time drug legalization advocates were concerned that it was too much too soon, that they actually thought that the state wasn't ready for this proposition this time around. So, you know, I think in that sense, the long-time established activists were acting maybe in a role similar to what political parties do. You know, and they would have said, hold it back, you know, scale it down, let's think a little more long-term and strategically about this. At the same time, maybe vested interests are too conservative in that way.
True. I mean, in this case, I think they're probably right. I mean, on the balance, it's like, it would have been better to see, like, on the balance, full legalization is better than complete prohibition, but if you're allowed to sort of tinker a bit, like, not quite full legalization would be better than full legalization given the circumstances, but, yeah.
Right. So the other topic that has been in the news, this weekend, the New York Times did a big story about cheese. And in particular about this kind of unholy alliance that has evolved between the government and sellers of cheese. And the way that it plays out is that there is a fee which all dairy producers are required by the federal government to pay. It kicks into a fund. That fund is supplemented by some direct money from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I think $5 or $6 million, in addition to the hundred and some million that the fee furnishes. That money goes to a firm, a sort of quasi-governmental firm called Dairy Management, which promotes the use of milk fat in things. This is mostly in the form of cheese. When Americans started drinking skim milk, there was all this delicious cow fat left over. And so we started...
When you put it that way, it sounds a lot grosser.
Yeah, no, it really does. It sounds super disgusting. And in fact, one of the results of this campaign is, I think, really sits very squarely on the disgusting, delicious divide, which is a Domino's pizza with twice as much cheese as the previous iteration. And this is literally something that money that dairy producers have no choice but to give by federal mandate went to nudge Domino's to put more cheese on stuff. The New York Times called this out as a sort of hypocrisy case because the U.S. Department of Agriculture also funds healthy living campaigns, anti-obesity
right.
campaigns, and in particular, in those campaigns, they discourage the eating of cheese and encourage the consumption of skim milk. So there is the hypocrisy angle, but I think the bigger story, to me at least, is that this is not a big story, that this is actually happening in all kinds of industries all the time. I mean, the classic example
yeah.
is that we subsidize corn production and thus corn syrup production, and then also
right.
Want to pass soda taxes and put out public awareness campaigns about the dangers of consuming too much sweetener. We also do this with meat. We overproduce meat and then force it on school lunch programs and other food supplement programs. So I guess to me the striking feature of the cheese story was how much it's not a story, how much it happens everywhere and always once the federal government gets up to a certain size. I'm interested to hear, obviously that is my reaction in part as a libertarian who's predisposed
right.
to see that angle, but I'm interested in your perception as well.
I mean, you know, my first reaction after reading it was similar, that this looks and sounds exactly like the outcome of federal intervention in providing corn subsidies, soybean subsidies, so on and so forth. I think when I was thinking about it more, one of the things I came away with as sort of a lesson for those of us who are interested in, say, in reducing obesity, the occurrence of obesity, and having Americans eat healthier diets, is that the first step, I mean, there's always a lot of talk about soda taxes and how can we tax various things to sort of reduce the incentive of consuming them. But it seems to me that really the ideal thing you could do is simply get rid of most, if not all of these subsidies, and most, if not all of these supports for the relevant industries. Part of the reason why meat is so ubiquitous is because corn is so ubiquitous, and if you're no longer subsidizing corn, then the full cost of meat production is a bit more apparent. And how would that affect people's consumption habits? Would people be so quick to eat those really gross soft Oreo things if they cost $6 a pack or $6 a box instead of like the $2.50 they are now?
Right. And yet we had also in the news this weekend the case of a professor who went on the convenience store diet. Did you see
yeah.
that story? So this is a guy who basically consumed pretty much exclusively foods that could be purchased at a convenience store, along with a vitamin, a protein shake, and I think some canned green beans or something.
Like a can of green beans, which sounds really awful.
Although, you know what? Secret confession. When I was a little kid, I loved to eat canned green beans.
I was just thinking that. I remember
yeah.
eating them a lot as a kid.
I think they were incredibly salty, which was part of
yes.
the part of the appeal. But the guy basically cut his daily calorie consumption from 2,300 calories a day to 1,800 calories a day and lost 27 pounds on the convenience store diet. This was in part to show that the kind of food deserts thing, the argument that lots of people don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables is not necessarily, shouldn't necessarily be the center of our debate about
right.
obesity. That it really is a calories in, calories out phenomenon more than you know some of the coverage might imply. But at the same time, as you know quite rightly, one reason that those foods are so ubiquitous, you know, one reason that you can get powdered donuts a lot more places than you can get kale is precisely because there's all these confusing layers of subsidies and price supports and industry supports out there. There is that question of if in your scenario all of those go away, what does the world look like? And at this point, I think it's hard to know because so many of those subsidies or industry programs have been in place since, in many places, since the Depression.
Right.
So our foodscape might be kind of unrecognizable at this point.
And beyond that, I mean, I'm not sure, for as much as we can do to sort of incentivize people consuming certain things, consuming better things or whatever, I'm not sure how much that would actually reduce obesity. Because at a certain point, I mean, like, obesity doesn't just exist among poor people. Obesity is a pretty, except for, like, the very wealthy or, like, the people on the, you know, the higher end of the income scale, obesity is pretty routine throughout the population. And so obviously that means that there are people who have perfectly fine access to fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, the whole nine yards, and simply choose not to eat them.
And actually this professor says his previous diet was one that he had thought of as healthy, that it was quite heavy on fruits and vegetables and whole grains and free range meat and stuff, so that there is perhaps a difference between eating healthy and being healthy, that isn't captured in the way the obesity debate is going right now. But of course, your point that it's cultural also points out the fact that maybe, as infuriating as they are, these government mandated funnels of money to encourage people to eat what we think of as unhealthy foods, you know, maybe they don't matter. Maybe that's not the thing in the end.
That is the other side of it, that, you know, the government can tell Domino's put more cheese in their pizzas. And really, that the issue is less the government telling Domino's to put cheese in their pizzas and the fact that lots of people want to eat Domino's pizzas.
Yeah.
Despite having other choices.
The other thing that made me incredibly sad in that New York Times story was the description of the head of dairy management, who sounded like just an incredible entrepreneur, just a real dynamo of a guy. and the fact that his talents were being wasted on this kind of coercive government-funded cheese boosterism, I think...
Maybe he really likes cheese.
It's true. It's possible that he is in that job out of pure personal conviction, that he really believes...
Pure conviction that Americans need more cheese in their diets.
Yes. But I think, if that's not the case, this is another argument for just the dangers of a huge government in which there are huge opportunities. This guy was getting $630,000 a year and first-class travel privileges. I mean, he was leading a sweet life. There was no reason for him to go elsewhere. And I think that points out something wrong when the guy in the quasi-governmental organization promoting cheese is earning twice as much, three times as much as the president. Although I guess now the president earns a little more, but certainly twice or three times as much as a senator. Something's gone a bit off the rails.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I was going to say something else about cheese, or not about cheese, but about the whole issue. And I just lost it.
Maybe it was just to share your favorite cheese-based recipe with our viewers. I don't know. but certainly I think that the question of what to do about this stuff is unfortunately mostly academic. I mean, this was an A1 story in the Sunday Times, and maybe this entity will cease to exist, but if I had to guess, and if this is too cynical, I would say it probably won't. I don't think this
I've hardly seen anyone talk about it outside of blogs.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is certainly a lesson how much of a dent you can make, even in what seems to be the most tidy, pure outrage of the day. I think the best possible outcome, right, is like Ron Paul or Tom Coburn or somebody briefly seizes the floor and makes a little speech about how this cheese thing can't stand, and then everyone kind of passes in the head, and they go away.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing, and now I just remembered what I was going to say, and related to the Twinkie Diet guy, is that, you mentioned that some of these subsidy programs have been around since the Great Depression. I think our food culture is pretty dysfunctional, but that's the product of a very long time, of mm-hmm. a lot of dozens of different little decisions, of different little policies, of different cultural shifts. And, if there's one sort of critique I have of the anti-obesity movement is that I'm not sure if they have the proper amount of humility with regards to the goal. That it took a very long time to get to where we are, and it will take probably even longer to reverse at least some of the, or change the culture around food.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think the case for humility should always be made when you have this mildly alarming convergence of, a huge nonprofit complex and government and celebrities. We've got your Jamie Olivers in on this.
Right.
I think anytime you see that kind of consensus around something must be done, that at least to me is always an occasion for alarm bells and perhaps a reminder to return to a more modest approach.
Yeah.
This has been a great conversation. I think it's crucial that we ended with the cheese course in the continental style. And I really enjoyed talking with you.
Same.